Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Greater New York Hospital Association conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require further assistance, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Terry Straub, and at this time, I would like to conduct a roll call. When you hear your hospital or your participating facility, please respond. Beth Israel Medical Center.
Operator, you don't have to have them respond. They can just run through the list of people who've actually signed on.
I'm sorry. Okay. The following participating facilities are as follows. Beth Israel Medical Center, Bronx Lebanon Hospital Center, Brookdale Hospital Medical Center, Cabrini Medical Center, Forest Hills Hospital, Franklin Hospital, Glen Cove Hospital, Good Samaritan Hospital Medical Center, Huntington Hospital, Interfaith Medical Center, St. John's Division, Lenox Hill Hospital, Long Beach Medical Center, Long Island College Hospital, Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Lutheran Medical Center, Montefiore Medical Center, Mount Sinai Hospital, Mount Sinai Hospital of Queens, New York Downtown Hospital, New York Methodist Hospital, New York Presbyterian Hospital, North General Hospital, North Shore University Hospital, NYU Medical Center, Our Lady of Mercy Medical Center, Peninsula Hospital, Plainview Hospital, Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, Southside Hospital, St. Catherine Siena Medical Center, St. Charles Hospital, St. Luke's Cornwall Hospital, St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital Center, Stamford Hospital, Staten Island University Hospital, Sisset Hospital, Trinitas Hospital, Wyckoff Heights Medical Center, HANYS, IPRO, United Hospital Fund, DOH, and Stream 57.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Terry Straub is here from Greater New York. This is Rachel Block from United Hospital Fund and Hillary Jalon, also from United Hospital Fund. And once again, thanks everybody for joining us. We've got another terrific turnout for this call, and we're very pleased that all of you could join us. We have a really terrific speaker today who's going to be our next agenda item. And just by way of a little bit of introduction, I think we had mentioned at previous meetings that the Health and Hospitals Corporation is involved in a parallel effort where they have their critical care unit directors working on both central line infection reduction strategies as well as ventilator pneumonia reduction strategies in the critical care units across Health and Hospitals Corporation. The United Hospital Fund is providing partial funding support for that effort. And as a result, both Terry and myself and Hillary have had the opportunity now to participate in the sort of parallel meetings that HHC has been having, and we hope to have a lot of information sharing going on between these two efforts so that we can really maximize the learning going on across all of the different institutions across the city. And as a result, when we met Dr. Ricardo Lopez from Queens Hospital Center at the midterm HHC learning session, which was shortly after our kickoff meeting back in March, we really thought that he had a terrific presentation that would be very relevant for our efforts and address some of the very specific questions that you all have been asking us on these calls regarding very practical how did you do this kind of stuff, and in particular illustrating the use of the PDSA cycles as a part of the overall improvement strategy. And so we were extremely pleased that Dr. Lopez was not only willing to participate in this call, but was quite enthusiastic about joining us today. And Hillary had made these arrangements with Dr. Lopez, so I'm just going to turn it over to her to give a brief introduction, and we'll turn it over to Dr. Lopez.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. I'll just let you know that Dr. Lopez is in attending in the pulmonary ICU as well as the section head for critical care at Queens Hospital Center. And like Rachel said, Queens Hospital Center has been participating in HHC's critical care collaborative. So we'll take about 20 minutes or so for Dr. Lopez to go through his presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers. Dr. Lopez?
Yes, hi. Good afternoon, everybody. And I just want to take a moment to thank Terry and Rachel and Hillary for inviting me to talk to you all today. As has been mentioned already, at the Health and Hospital Corporation, we've already initiated a parallel collaborative with the Greater New York Hospital Associations and United Hospital Fund, looking at ways to kind of homogenize care across the corporation and share ideas and see how others are doing and how we can do better. Now, keep in mind that it's a very large corporation, about 11 hospitals, and all of them with different stratification of ICUs as such. So what works at one place doesn't necessarily work at the other, and I think that's part of the problem that this a collaborative of this size that you all are involved in are going to face. I'm just going to go through briefly explaining a little bit about the background to this and how my hospital works. As part of the collaborative, all of the HHC facilities have actually put together a team. The second slide, I guess, lists my team, and as you can see, it has some medical leadership in it. Dr. Fleischman is my boss and the heart and soul of the team. Dr. Ingraldi, my surgical counterpart. On the nursing side, we definitely have great assistance from senior nursing leadership as well as the ICU nurse and infection control nurses, as well as respiratory care. So it's a multidisciplinary approach in the way to get things done. My critical care unit is actually pretty unique even within the corporation in the sense that we are one combined unit for three services, MICU, SICU, as well as CCU. It's 17 beds, 10 of which are full ICU beds, 7 are step-down beds, which can be upweighted. Our average daily census, which is estimated at about 16 patients every day. The aim statement for our team was to improve the outcomes of our critically ill patients, again, utilizing multidisciplinary approaches, patient-centered and evidence-based best practices to improve patient outcomes. Now, the goals within our own collaborative are to have this done by December of 2005. Our last meeting, actually, they hinted it may be extended somewhat. The population of focus that we have includes all critically ill patients admitted to our unit. Now, what I can tell you is that that means all comers, and we have CCU patients and SICU patients all in one cohort, so to speak. Going to the next slide, we have the aims, statement, goals, and as it focuses on central venous catheters, we chose to try to meet and exceed the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance Rate, the NIST rate. We chose that as our benchmark, and one of the problems we face is that we can't benchmark against other hospitals for the reasons I mentioned, different size, different staffing, different cultures, so to speak. We also want to use a central line bundle consistently, at least 95% of the time. So the question is, now that you have that, well, how do you get there? Well, if you go to the next slide, I can give you a little bit of background. This was not something new for us. We actually had approached this problem before. Thereabouts 2002, 2003, we started a patient safety initiative on central venous catheters, in part due to an unacceptable bloodstream infection rate. At that time, we collaborated with the infection control nurses as well as with the surgical staff as well as medical. We developed a new hospital policy for the insertion and maintenance of central venous catheters. We put together a staff education program that created an instructional video as well as an in-service, which happens once to twice a year, going through hands-on how to prep and drape and so forth and how to gown appropriately. Also, return demonstration of the staff is included, where they show us how they're doing, and we troubleshoot and go through that process. At the time, we were still not utilizing consistently across all services antibiotic-coated catheters, and we switched all our stock to be antibiotic-impregnated. Another thing we did at that time was to create a central line insertion kit. Now, the kit was an interesting thing because it actually carried over very good benefits. We actually, during that time, moved from a very old building to a new building, and part of that brought in a Pyxis machine, which limited our staff's access to the materials needed to insert central lines. So we already had this kit in fabricated and in use, so it kind of circumvented that problem. The kit basically includes everything you would need to insert the central line, including chloroprep, chlorhexidine scrubs, gauze, suture material. It includes flush, syringes, caps, masks, sterile gloves, and it includes a drape for the patient. It has pre-cut fenestrations. It's pretty much very large, covers the whole bed. Those of you that are part of HAC, I don't know if any are out there, have probably seen a sample of it at one of our meetings. We also put together a kit to maintain the lines, a dressing kit. At that time, we started monitoring our infection rate with the infection control nurses and implementing provider feedback. This work was actually published in Haney's about the end of December, if I remember correctly. It documented an 81.4% reduction in our BSI rate as compared to our peak rate. Our rates were running pretty high, 18 to 34 infections per 1,000 catheter days. After the project was implemented, we had dropped to about 5.5. Now, that was all good, and everybody was very happy. However, our bliss didn't last long, as the results were not sustainable. What we noticed is shortly after the in-services and when attention is drummed up for BSIs, the rates drop. As, you know, people kind of forget a bit, the rates start to creep up slowly. Another part of that package was purchasing a ultrasound to help in reducing mechanical complications. And serial NIPORTS data from our hospital revealed a significant reduction of mechanical complications. If I'm not wrong, it would be zero or very near zero at this time. So getting to the central CVC or central venous catheter bundle, it's a nice article published by Provenos that actually speaks to this. It was published in Critical Care Medicine thereabouts 2004. And pretty much this common sense things in the bundle, hand hygiene, maximum barrier precautions, chlorhexidine skin antisepsis, and appropriate catheter site, daily review necessity, and no routine replacements. Many of these are covered by hospital policy, and our policy reflects much of this. The remainder of the bundle is covered by the central line kit that we use to insert the lines. The other thing we did to try to capture this data was to implement a checklist. We also empowered our ICU nurses to stop any insertion if the infection control measures were not adhered to. So if they're going to put in a line, the nurse would have a checklist and be supervising that these measures were actually adhered to. And this list was given, was prepared with the nurses, and the information that comes out of the article from Provenos as well as our own input. And the nurses, with our support, bought into it, and we started our journey, so to speak. So I'll get to our PDSAs at this time. This would be the slide number 10, I guess, in your handouts. And it's PDSA cycle number one. So at the time this form was prepared, we tested it in late February, and we did it very small. All right, if you go very large, you're going to find a lot of problems in getting everybody to do it. One nurse was selected to do it once, and the feedback included a successful use of the checklist. And based on this, the success of using it, we decided to get other nurses to try it. So going to cycle two, we revised the form. The infection control nurses wanted a scoring system in there to try to gauge where we were with it. And the new form was tested again, very small, one nurse, one patient, once, and it was tested successfully. No issues with the nurse monitoring the physicians were observed. Again, this took some discussion with our team and the nursing teams that it would be supported, and the nurses knew to go up the ladder if any issues were encountered. So We then went to cycle three, in which we wanted to extend it to different tours. So, yeah, it happens well during the day when everybody's there, but can it happen at night? And, yes, it was successfully extended to all tours of duty. Between February and the end of May, we have used it about 33 times. Again, initially it was one patient, one line, so all our lines are not represented in this block of time. Our plan is to continue this practice for all central line insertions. What we noted was that if there were any breaches in infection control practices, it was usually found to be related to an emergency situation. Conclusion that we can draw from that is that the implementation of a checklist by IC nurses can be done with pretty good acceptance by both physicians and nursing staff. Now, again, when I describe my unit, my hospital in itself is a teaching hospital. We're affiliated with the Mount Sinai Hospital of New York City. So we have a pulmonary critical care fellowship as well as a medical residency. Hence, we have, it may be different to some of the hospitals that are listening in. Critical care nurses and medical leadership need to collaborate to ensure the success of this empowerment. And getting the message to all your providers is very key. So after that, we went to cycle four. And we actually wanted to see if we can catch all the insertions. Now, obviously, we're not perfect yet, and this is a work in progress. We modify the forms as needed, and we modify the procedures as we see the results coming in through the different cycles. What we found was that all lines weren't captured. If a line was placed outside of our unit, well, then we wouldn't have the form, obviously. Those coming out of the OR would most likely, one would assume, be sterilely inserted. However, we chose to review the chart and look for documentation of appropriate sterile insertion technique, and then we would keep the line. Otherwise, the line would be changed at the next appropriate moment. Any line that didn't meet documentation standards would be replaced or removed. These include those from the ER or from the medical wards. Going to cycle five, we wanted to see what happened while they were doing the checklist. In other words, so if the inserter does not follow policy and the nurse halts him and then he corrects his deficiency, well, that the first form really didn't capture that. So we modified our form to reflect whether or not reminders were necessary or not. And this was kind of just to know exactly what was needed during that particular insertion, because we wanted a part of the form and the whole process to include provider feedback. So if you have a provider that's not meeting the standard, well, then one of us would go and speak to this person and, you know, find out what's the problem. Going on to cycle six, it was an interesting situation where while all this was going on, we actually went through our unannounced JACO survey. But taking that into the fray, so to speak, we saw an opportunity to bundle two patient safety initiatives together. So we modified our form to include the timeout procedure, which was a bit redundant having different forms. For documentation purposes, we continue to have the two forms, but we're looking in the future to kind of have it in one. Right now, our checklists are not part of the medical record. We're compiling them for statistical purposes only. So we added a row to document the completion of the timeout forms. The next slide, which would be slide 16, is a copy of the form we're using currently. And again, it's been modified many times and probably will be modified many times more. I would encourage any of you that wish to use it to feel free and make modifications as you wish. And if you need a clean digital copy, I'd be happy to provide it to anybody that would like to. So we have a work in progress. And when you insert the lines, most of us try to do a good job inserting it, and our checklist kind of showed that. So if the problem's not really inserting it, aside from the emergency insertions, well, what happens after the line is in? Well, obviously we use it, and obviously the patient would have to have some sort of dressing. We decided to look at the maintenance of our dressings, and that started off a different branch of PDSA cycles. And again, we started very small, one nurse, one patient. And what we did is we had a critical care nurse on the day tour just go around and look at the dressings. And what she found were that 50% of the ones she looked at, she felt needed to be redone. And she went ahead and did them, and immediate feedback was given to the staff. So that went on to PDSS cycle 2. 5 days later, we had another nurse go around, and all were felt to be 100% compliant. Okay. Going on to PDSA cycle 3, which would be, I guess, slide 19 for everybody, we decided to put together a checklist to monitor the status of the CVC dressing maintenance. It included 4 indicators, which were just checkoffs, yes or no. Is it dressing occlusive? Is it wet? Is it soiled? And date of time of the CVC dressing, was it present or not? In other words, was this dressing labeled and dated and timed? Now, the PDSA cycles were performed on the day tour by different nursing staff and with pretty good acceptance. Cycle 4, we wanted to include timing of dressing monitoring. We actually changed the timing to the night tour. And that was pretty interesting because one of the things that happened was, well, if you go in at different times, you're going to find different condition of dressings. Obviously, when they're washing and cleaning the patients, dressings may get dislodged or they're likely to get changed. So if you monitor afterwards, they're likely to be compliant. So what we decided to do was get the night team to monitor and see when the nurses come in, are they clean in the evening? In other words, the day team, have they left them well? The evening team would pick that up. The ICU nurse receiving sign-out at change of shift was felt to be the person to complete the checklist as part of sign-out process. So the next slide, which is 21, shows the first form we used. And you can see it's very simple, yes or no. The only problem we found with this form was that when it was correct, the checks would be in different sides of the column. Made reading a little bit difficult, but we found that out as we used it. We also wanted the dressing time to be documented. So we actually modified the form and made them all to line up yes in one column or no in one column, either the compliant in the yes column or you have a fall off and you have a place for remarks. It also includes the date, the time, and the location of the line. What we did after that is to, as I mentioned, we wanted to incorporate it at the sign-out procedure. The next slide, which is 24, is a rough copy of the back sheet of our ICU flow sheet. To get this done consistently and avoid redundancy, we felt it would be very appropriate to incorporate it in the back of our ICU flow sheet. Now, this is not yet part of the medical record. We just fabricated the back page separately, and we don't want the nurses to document anything redundantly, so they're only using the dressing monitor part of it. And you have 2 shifts, and you can identify which of the nurses that were involved in it, so it allows for provider feedback. The other thing we felt that was a very interesting thing to tie in here, which is going to be part of this PDSA, if you look at the last line on the bottom, is to incorporate oral care. We previously had no way to document that oral care was given or if there were any issues with it. So that's going to be folded into this. Going to slide 25, the process outcomes. We found that the compliance with the CVC bundle was not where we want it, and it's a work in progress. We have about 91% when you tally all of them together. 3 fall-offs, 2 were emergent, 1 was not emergent. Provider feedback was given to each one of those lines. The dressing maintenance going from March to May 8th actually is 100% compliant. So the nurses have been trying to do a better job at that. And, again, if they're looking at you, well, it's likely that you're not going to want them to be correcting you. If you go to the next slide, this is a graph of the central line bundle use. We want to get it up over 95, and our hopes are that it will get there shortly. Going to our BSI rate, this is not reflecting, I guess, any changes that are implemented on small scale. Would not be likely to show any impact. However, in the past, our BSI rates dropped dramatically after any in-service, and that's what we would expect here. If you look, March was a trouble month for us. We are a small hospital, about 220 beds, with very low device usage. One infection for us puts us at 7 to 9%, 9 infections per 1,000 catheter days. So that January and April date are 1 infection each. The March rate of 17 represents 2 infections, one of which sparked a lot of discussion. It was a very interesting case that had abdominal sepsis. It was a surgical patient with an infected abdominal wound. The clinicians felt that it was a secondary BSI. The infection control nurses felt that they could not be called that because cultures were not drawn to prove that there was no other, that the belly was the only source. So that was an interesting thing. Based on that case, we started doing root cause analysis on the BSIs as they occurred. One was traced back to a blood-soaked dressing, felt to be the likely source of the infection. As I said, the other one was a surgical wound, and whether it was primary or secondary was food for a lot of discussion. Future plans for us include to perform concurrent RCAs on all CVC bloodstream infections. The most important changes that we implemented was empowering the ICU nurse to say, hey, stop. If you're not going to do it right, I'm going to call somebody that will. That alone would be enough to stop most people. Most people, as I mentioned, would not want to be corrected. Use of a CVC insertion checklist can be done, and the evolutionary process of the PDSAs can help you get there. It can help on all fronts. We took it from the ICU nurse supervisor and moved it down to the frontline staff. And by incorporating the monitoring tool at the change of tour, it aids a bit in keeping with the ICU flow or workflow. The checklists are easily modifiable if you do them in small scale, and they can ensure compliance and allow for provider-specific feedback. What we learned from this is that it can be done. And again, those of you, I'm actually pulmonary critical care. I've never seen a patient stop smoking that didn't want to. Central line infections, you can't make a change unless you really want to. So what works for us may not work for you, but I'm sure some pieces or all of it or maybe none of it would be helpful for the rest of the crowd. Success depends, however, on not disrupting the ICU flow workflow. If you can work it into normal processes, you're likely to have it nurse buy-in, physician buy-in, and be successful in it. Do it small and allow for ongoing analysis, and as the problems arise and the provider feedback gets in, you can go ahead and implement these changes. Of note, our nurses at one point complained that the forms were evolving too quickly, and before they learned how to do one, it was already changed. Now, it's a bad thing and a good thing, where I'd rather have them learn the good form than learn bad forms and have to retrain them. But that was one observation we had. In our particular situation, observation, which just having a heightened awareness of BSIs and the procedures and the maintenance of the lines, that likely played a major role in our success. But then I ask you, is that a bad thing? I'll take a low BSI rate, preferably a zero BSI rate, any way I can get it. With that, I'll be open to questions.
Thank you very much. Operator, if you would instruct folks on the procedure for the question-answer phase.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. If your question has been answered and wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key. One moment. Our first question comes from Joseph Cook from New York Presbyterian Hospital.
I enjoyed the presentation very well. Two questions and maybe a comment. One is the pushback I get from my nursing staff is has to be one of staffing. Sometimes they may be covering three patients and cannot actually perform the observation for us. Have you run into that problem, number one? Number two, do your nurses get involved in checking the credentials of the person, of the operator doing the procedure? Because that's an issue we will be facing as we put in our new policy.
Actually, those are very good questions. To answer the first one, incorporating it into the sign-out procedure, I've not run into trouble with the nurses performing it. It's a very quick and easy thing, and if it needs to be changed, it's very quick to change. Again, putting it into the workflow. With regards to the credentialing, that is a very good point and something we've been looking at. They are not getting into it just yet, but my feeling is that it will be incorporated into the checklist. And part of the problem we have here is getting together a list of who is credentialed or not.
Yeah, we have a similar problem here.
Exactly, but the checklist does lend itself to that.
Mm.
And as soon as the administration here gets us a list we can go by that so-and-so is credentialed, then the checklist can be modified.
Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. One moment. Our next question comes from a Finkelstein blonde from Mount Sinai Hospital.
Yes, we would like to know whether or not you have a charge nurse structure in your intensive care unit to help facilitate getting these things done.
I'm not familiar with charge nurse structure. We do have a head nurse in our ICU, and she is playing a supervisory role there. She initiated actually doing the bundles and then pushed it out to the frontline work staff. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah. Does the head nurse take on patient responsibilities in the ICU? Does she take care of patients as well, or does she just manage?
I would say that she does both. When permitted, she does the managerial role. When she needs to take on patients, she takes on patients.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key.
Dr. Lopez, this is Terry Straub from Greater New York. I was just curious about the video that you put together. How do you roll that out, and who do you show that video to? Are the nurses involved in seeing it?
It's a good question, Terry. The video is in our medical library, and it's shown to all the house staff as they enter and to any new employee that would be involved with line placement. Aside from that, anybody can go to the library and sign it out. I am not aware the nurses, per se, would do it unless they are a nurse practitioner or some other higher-end nurse. But it's generally the physicians, the PAs, and anybody else that would be inserting the lines.
But just those inserting the lines.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We have a follow-up question from Lori Finkelstein Blonde from Mount Sinai Hospital.
Yeah, I'm sort of fielding the questions for everybody in the room here at Mount Sinai. The other question that we had here at the table was, when a positive blood culture comes back, depending upon when it is, you may not have the individuals there who are involved with the line insertion itself. There may be a whole separate staff in the ICU at that time. How do you take care of your little root cause analysis to do it in a timely fashion is our question. What do you do?
Well, the checklist actually has the inserter documented there. And if it is not, then we can always go to the medical record and see the procedure note, who put it in. We're a small hospital, so it's actually rather easy. If it's the medical side, actually, we share the same fellows. So it's not that difficult to find out who the inserter is for us.
Can I answer the question? Do you have a follow-up? Right. You've got Maxine.
My question is, when becomes positive.
Sorry, I can't hear too clearly.
Once a blood culture becomes positive, who brings it to your attention, and when do you sit down with the individuals involved to determine if it was a system error or a human error, basically?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Actually, we have an infection control nurse that does daily rounds in our ICU. She would be the one to bring it to either my attention or my surgical counterpart's attention, or either that or my boss.
Okay.
And as the infections arise, we have made working arrangements with them, and they freely call us, and we go right away because we really want to get on top of it and drill down our BSI rates and make sure that we're reporting accurate data.
So do you have your ICP involved in each of the root causes? What if it happens on a weekend?
Again, we're a small hospital. If it happens on a weekend, then it would be reviewed on the first working day.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, sure, please.
You've been using the antibiotic-impregnated catheter.
Yes.
Are you sure that that's not also having an effect on your infection rates?
It's interesting because we actually went to them with our first patient safety initiative, and we did see a very dramatic drop. However, those results were not sustainable, and we would bounce up, you know, as well as long as people started to forget a little bit about the in-servicing and all the commotion we were making, those rates would creep up. So while they do help, it's a little more than just the catheter itself. I don't think that that is the only reason they come down. We've been using those catheters for about three or four years, and the rates have been erratic.
Is your plan ultimately, once your infection rate is, you know, consistently low, to withdraw use of the impregnated catheter, just thinking about resistance, et cetera?
Well, I'll tell you that at this point, you know, if you look at most of the guidelines, they recommend the use of it if you have a problem with your infection rate. If we can get it low enough and consistently enough that, you know, we may want to go back to non-antibiotic coated, that would be something to discuss at that time. It's not nothing formal has been discussed about it, but certainly something that we can entertain. Obviously, with the new sepsis guidelines, changing over to catheters with the continuous O2 saturation capability is also a very entertaining alternative.
Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. Our next question comes from Grace Langan from Lutheran Medical Center.
Hi. You didn't mention, Dr. Lopez, if your biopatch is part of your initial package, and is it part of the maintenance kit?
Yes, it is, actually. We included the biopatch in our dressing kit. The insertion kit, actually, I neglected to mention, comes hand-in-hand with a dressing kit. The dressing kit includes a tegaderm or transparent membrane covering, as well as a biopatch and sterile gauze. We do use the biopatch. Again, it takes, funny enough, a little in-servicing. You'll find it put anyway except the way it's supposed to be put on. But with consistency and you know, frequent reminders, it can be done. And we've been doing a lot better in having the nurses put it on appropriately. But, yes, we do use the biopatch, the chlorhexidine impregnated biopatch.
And is that being used across the corporation hospitals?
To be honest, I could not answer that question.
But we can find out.
We can find out.
We're going to have Karen Scott Collins is going to join us for a future call to talk about the overall HHC strategy, but we'll try to get a specific answer to that question prior to her participating.
Thank you.
Actually, part of our HHC Critical Care Collaborative was to standardize care across our corporation. So that said, before this collaborative, we really never talked to each other. So we all did our own thing. Now that we've been at the table for, I guess, about 2 years, trading ideas, I do believe others have bought into the kit we use here, and I would not be surprised if they're not already using it. I've given the name of the company that supplies us to several of our colleagues.
Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Kathy Shannon from St. Catherine of Siena.
Yes, I'd like to know when you started using the biopatch, or did you just start incorporating it with the kit and with the bundle that you just started?
Oh, good question. Actually, the first safety initiative that we started thereabouts late 2002 to 2003, the one that was published in the Haney's publication, when we put together our central line insertion kit, and at that time was when we started using the biopatch. So that's about 2-3 years ago. It's not a new part of this central line bundle that we did with this collaborative, nor with the PDSA. That was already in use.
And how frequently do you do your dressing changes?
Again, the dressing changes would be usually every 7 days or as needed. Quite frankly, it's more common than not to have it needed more frequently. And any time the dressing, again, with this PDSA cycle, if the nurse comes and sees that it's not occlusive, it's going to get changed. So it's been more frequent. I can't comment on how frequent they are changing it. It can be daily or more. But the key here is to pay attention to the dressing maintenance. Every time they change it, it gets a new biopatch. But the biopatch, if you read the insert, I believe is good for 7 days or until it becomes saturated.
Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Elaine McGugan from Long Beach Medical Center.
Hi. I have a question. When we're talking about dressing maintenance for the CVC, nothing addresses the end caps, the PRN adapters. How often are you changing them, and why are we not even discussing them?
Well, I think you just gave us our next PDSA, actually. We used needleless end caps. To my knowledge, we don't frequently change them. Using the needleless system, you don't really need to change them except on initial insertion. But certainly that would be something to look at for a new PDSA.
It was my understanding that with the caps should be changed when and if they're full of blood. And as far as just your preparation for entering them, do you use ChlorPrep on the caps? Do you use alcohol on the caps? Do you use a valve system? Because the valve system, the ClearLink system, which some hospitals are using, had a problem with infection with them because they were cleaning them without the valve being elevated. So there seems to me that there's a lot of problems with the end caps or PRN adapters on the central lines.
Well, you're absolutely right. And not only that, there are also problems with the sutures used to secure the lines. With regards to the caps, I believe our nurses are using alcohol. They're not using ChloroPrep yet. They are cleaned beforehand. The exact nursing policy I would not know. But certainly, as I mentioned, it would be something to look at another PDSA cycle. With regards to what I mentioned about the sutures, we are looking at the StatLox, which would be a sutureless fixing device.
Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question comes from Mary Matique from Trinitas Hospital.
Yes, hi. We wanted, if you could, clarify on who you is an assistant. You said define assistant.
Yeah. Well, we have a medical residency, and we have a pulmonary critical care fellowship. We also have house physicians that work in the Department of Cardiology, as well as house physicians in the Department of Surgery. That said, we also have many students. An assistant can be anything from a student up to a resident, a house officer, even an attending. Pretty much we don't discriminate as long as the inserter is credentialed or the supervisor is credentialed.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key.
Hi, this is Terry again from Greater New York. Just because I'm a little bit naive to the entire role of the assistant, and there seems to be some issues with the nurses not being available to assist with the checklist, is it feasible in instances where there is an assistant to empower the assistant to be trained to do the checklist?
I would say
are already sterile gloved, and it would be not feasible.
I would say that the assistant probably would not be the best person to do the checklist, only for the reason that it may not be a skilled person. The nurses have been in service as to what we expect, and we get more consistent. We would get more consistent data from that. Remember, a student that's very nervous may not want to say that his resident didn't do A, B, or C.
Right. Understood. I was just wondering
right.
what the feasibility is since nursing.
Well, certainly it takes buy-in from both nursing and physicians. And again, not that we don't face our own issues when there's an emergency and the nurses are short. You can get some grumbling, and that's normal across any hospital. But by and large, to change the culture, one has to do it consistently. And over time and consistent with consistency, you can achieve your success.
Do you educate the students and residents through that checklist process?
As what I would guess is most hospitals, you need to do a certain amount under direct supervision before you are credentialed. So if a junior person is the inserter, the assistant should be somebody credentialed and senior.
I'm just wondering if they're familiar with the paperwork and
Well, that's they do have the residents do have an orientation. The students, quite frankly, in such a large pool of residents and fellows, the students don't do any lines. They're lucky, you know, they get to see and they get to assist maybe. They're not credentialed anyway to be doing any invasive procedures. So what can I tell you? It's a process where you have to be, you know, they get there in service, they get the tape, they get the hands-on, and then they get to do with a credentialed provider.
But if things are working properly, they would be exposed to the whole process that you have set up with the nurses doing the checklist.
Right. Well, they are informed that the nurses can't stop them. They are given the checklist. Actually, we had the residents in service today. You know, all the points are gone over with them, and they are familiar with the form, yes.
Our next question comes from Robert Garcia from Brookdale Hospital.
Yes, just a comment. Thank you for that lecture. It was very good. A comment about these needleless connectors. At the recent infection control conference in Baltimore, Dr. Jarvis had presented information in regard to contamination of these needleless connectors. He reviewed five reports in regard to these connectors. And it's not just PosiFlow. There are a number of other connectors that are involved and have had reports, you know, in different states in regard to the contamination. Although most of these studies in review that we did here point to the fact that one of the reasons they got contaminated was a break in technique where the nurses did not clean the ports properly. And there's also another study which points now that it's more effective to use chlorhexidine to clean the sites prior to, you know, using a syringe, inserting medications, things like that.
Good point.
Our next question or comment comes from... Alexis Ramondi from Beth Israel Medical Center.
No problem.
You may proceed with your question.
Beth
Israel?
Alexis Ramondi?
No, I don't have
any. Our next question comes from a follow-up question from Mary Matigue from Trinitas Hospital.
Yes, we just, I'm sorry to, I just wanted to clarify it, the assistant. That would be anybody who may be attempting to put the line in. It would not be the nurse who is assisting setting up the procedure. So the nurse who's setting up would not need to be in full barrier garb.
No, correct. The assistant would be the one helping the inserter.
Right, the resident and the fellow or the intensivist and the resident.
Correct.
Yes, okay, thank you.
Sure.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or a comment, please press the 1 key.
Operator, actually, I think unless you do have anybody else in the queue, we're probably ready to move on with the rest of our agenda. Do you have anybody else in the queue at this point?
Showing no further questions.
Thank you very much. Dr. Lopez, we know you have to run back to your clinic, and on behalf of all of us on this call, we really appreciate your taking the time, your presentation, and we'll probably be back in touch with you as we'd expect we'll have some additional follow-up questions from folks as we go along.
Oh, thank you very much. If anybody's interested in me sending them any of these checklists or whatever, I'd be happy to share it with them.
I think what we will do, Dr. Lopez, is we will reach out to you and Hillary will disseminate it through the Gen 8. Everyone can get copies of the materials.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, we'll proceed through the agenda. We have about 20 minutes or so. We just want to give an update on some of the reports that we received for the June 20th deadline. I'll just take about 5 minutes to present a summary of what kinds of information we got from you. There were three reports. One was the baseline data collection form reports, which we got quite a few of pretty much from almost everyone. And then the two that I'm going to focus on now are the monthly team reports and the monthly leader reports. I have gotten some phone calls from different different people in the collaborative, which was great, and they asked some questions, and we guided them through filling them out. And there's also a team checkup form that's very useful, where you just monitor your team's progress. We did send a reminder out to those of you that have not provided us with the monthly team reports and the leader reports today. And just to go through what we got from you so far to date, about a third of you focused at least in part on communicating the CLABS collaborative and trying to achieve buy-in from leadership at the hospital. And then the other four big things that seem to be a focus in the reports were standardizing materials for the CLABS collaborative. And Dr. Lopez talked a lot about that in his talk. For instance, standardizing the insertion pack, quite a few of you focused on for the monthly reports, dressing change kit standardization, and maximal barrier kits. The other area that was one of the larger areas of focus was planning for the implementation or actually beginning to implement the bundle. And one hospital even started monitoring the use of the bundle in the report. Another big area, really big area actually, was creating and or modifying the central line insertion care team checklist. And then two hospitals actually talked about how they're empowering nursing staff to monitor physician practice. Finally, the next larger topic that was a focus was daily goal sheets. A few of you have piloted daily goal sheets during interdisciplinary rounds. Also, some of you were revising your current daily goal sheets, and then others were obtaining approval by various committees at the hospitals for the revised daily goal sheets. We wanted to also give you a couple hints for putting these reports together, because some people have said to us, little difficult to put them together, especially with regard to the data collection part for the PDSA cycles. So one thing that I thought Dr. Lopez made a really good point of saying was start small. Really start looking at the data, collect data on one nurse and one patient at first. It's going to be difficult to monitor progress if you start with too much too soon. And then this will enhance your process improvements moving forward. Just as an example, I think we have an example on the Jenny website for central line insertion care team list. The one thing you could do if you're implementing that, you can monitor the percentage of patients who have central line insertions that had all components of the checklist completed. That's a really clear-cut example how to do that. All the forms, once again, are on the Jenny site. They're in the data collection forms and reports section. We got a couple questions about that. And finally, I just want to talk about the team assessment scale. There's the back page of the senior leadership report. There's a page where you monitor your overall team, improvements and what you've done during the month. And it's a scale from 1 to 5 where you see how you've done overall for the month. Most of you who gave us the reports were at about a 2, which is activity but no changes. The team is actively engaged in developing, learning, and discussing, but no changes have been tested. And that's pretty much right about where we'd expect you to be at this point the first month. So it's just good to use this sheet every month to see how much you've improved over the upcoming months. That's pretty much all I wanted to say about the reports. Thank you for those of you who gave them to us on time. And sort of on the same note, we wanted to try to get some volunteers for the next conference call. And we've all individually talked to some of you about possibly coming on to the next call to describe your experience with the CLABS initiative to date. So I'll open it up right now for questions and hopefully volunteers for the
the next call. And we're looking probably for two hospitals just to talk about your experience to date. And even if you're not far along or you're having a lot of problems, it may be a good opportunity to get some feedback from others on the call on how to overcome some of the barriers that you are facing.
Operator, can we open the line up?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key. Our first question or comment comes from Umesh Gidwani from Mount Sinai Hospital, Queens.
Can you give me the fax number to send out our report?
Sure. You can send it to 212.
Yeah.
Hold on. We didn't come prepared for that one. Oh. Here we go. 212-262-6350.
Thank you.
Roseanne has changed her name now, so it's now Roseanne Casey.
Right.
She's not married.
Not De Niro. So if you were sending them to Roseanne De Niro, please send them to Roseanne Casey.
But she'll take them either way.
But she'll take them either way. But her email has changed.
Yes.
Any other questions? Volunteers?
Once again, any questions or comments, please press the 1 key.
We'll follow up with you individually to see if we can recruit some volunteers offline from the call. We've seen some good reports, and we really love to have you share the information as we go forward. But we can follow up offline.
Can I ask an operator you can keep the lines open so that on to this question. So far, we've been posting a lot of material on the Jenny website, and we have Dr. Shannon's presentation up there. Is the material, we would just like some feedback, is the material useful? How could we improve sending out information to you? Hillary did put together a really nice newsletter that we will continue to send out to everyone, and we're hoping that you can disseminate it throughout your own facility or take an electronic version, put it in your own hospital newsletters or up on your intranet site so that this information is spreading throughout the hospital. But we'd really like some feedback, like to find out, are you using Dr. Shannon's presentation? Is it a good training tool? Was it worth recording it? Because as we move forward with this project, although it's a central line project, the real overall goal is to develop models for improving quality within organizations. So any of your feedback would be appreciated, either online now or separately. But we would love to hear a little bit now. Just a couple of comments would be appreciated.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment, please press the 1 key.
I don't know if that means it's useful, not useful.
We have gotten individual
right.
Emails back from folks indicating that they have appreciated the information. As Terry said, we're just trying to figure out how to make it, you know, most useful and easiest for you to use.
And we are working on changing the homepage to the Jenny site so that information is a little more accessible to everyone.
We actually have a comment from Lori Finkelstein Blund from Mount Sinai Hospital.
Oh, Lori. Thank you, Lori.
I'll be honest. We're trying to figure out, you know, how we can, you know, utilize the video for everybody to see. And not, you know, when you're thinking about critical care, people are working in a busy place, it's hard, and flex time, et cetera, it's very, very difficult to get people to watch a video. And so we actually, one of our QA nurses, Bernice, actually ordered a CD from you guys, which I don't know if we could have made by downloading it directly off the website or not. But what we would like to do is get that into some type of a format so that they could pop it in a video machine when people are on break, listen to it, you know, in the conference room on the units.
Do you have VHS or DVD? What format do most hospitals have now for showing this type of AV stuff?
VHS.
Well,
here, Right.
We're going to make some more VHS tapes. It's interesting, when you try to copy VHS now, not a lot of places do it. They want to convert everything into a DVD.
Right. I don't think we're up with, I don't think we have, you know, on the units, we have the old, I hate to say, VCRs, and, you know, that's what's available for, you know, very directly right now. So, you know, it might be, we were going to try to convert one. Well, we did get a DVD. We understand you were already out of the VCR, out of the video.
Right, we're making more of those.
Right, okay.
But maybe it's just worth an investment, a handheld DVD player. I'm just, for $100.
Yeah.
I know, it's a tight.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, that's a thought. Okay.
The only comment I'll make on the DVD, if we convert the DVDs, that's the easiest and most cost-saving way of doing this, is the DVD will be a full-blown picture of Dr. Shannon, and then you'd have to use a hard copy of the slides on the DVD. We don't seem to be able to link the presentation with the slideshow. On the CD-ROM that's on the computer, we could do that, but not on the DVD. My other question is, do you have an intranet site within your facility, and would it be practical then to see if your IT people could just directly download his presentation from our website and hook it right into your intranet site so that it's accessible on the unit?
That is possible. We do have an intranet site, and we could check and see if they could do that. And then it could be like we have this what's new category. You know, we might, it could be seen, yeah.
I think the real challenge with all of quality, and I know everyone on the call has been working on these issues forever, is disseminating the information, and that's why we're never able to maintain the gains on these as new staff come and go. So something we'd really love to learn out of this entire collaborative is how to best disseminate information. So we'll really be reaching out to you to try to figure out how to do it best, how to use technology that's available. If hospitals have an intranet site, to really promote using it and using your intranet site, linking it up with other organizations' information. But I know your IT department may have firewalls and different issues that you will have to deal with to obtain this video presentation for your intranet site. And we're happy to work on our end to see what we could do there.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the monthly newsletter that Hillary sent out, that's another article of information that contains a lot of information, best practices, and we'd really like to see that disseminated broadly.
Oh, you mean beyond the CLABS grouping?
Yeah, beyond the other parts of the hospital, anesthesiology,
right.
They really haven't been involved too much in this collaborative.
Oh. We've actually, Terry, incorporated anesthesia, you know, in all our communications.
That's great.
So we're getting input from them.
And how about the ED?
The ED, I don't know how much involvement we've had from them yet, but we're going to work on that. But anesthesia is definitely on board.
Right. And given the limited resources all of you have, I think if we can start disseminating the materials, let them start getting a flavor for the information, they'll be more accepting of changing or adopting new protocols once you do become more involved with them.
Right. Okay.
I think we'll see if we can do an audio version of Dr. Shannon's presentation and make it available in a format that could be put on iPods, since everybody has iPods these days. So if they aren't able to actually watch the presentation, we might be able to do just an audio version and figure out a way for you guys to help people download it to their iPods. We'll do podcasting.
Podcasting.
We got to get with the, you know, with the program here. Anyway,
it may be also helpful. Hillary and I were speaking. Maybe we could do 10 questions to go along with Dr. Shannon's presentation and then do a CME version of this. So it would be the presentation, they answer the test, they fax it back to Greater New York and successfully pass the test, we can then send you a certificate for 1 hour of CME, or I think it's about 1.6 hours.
That would be good.
I think that would go over, actually.
So?
You could give CMEs. I think people would do it, yeah.
Okay. So we'll look into doing that. In fact, we will do it. If anyone has any questions you think we should include in that test, please send it to us, because we are certainly not the content experts.
Yeah.
That's the next step that we plan on. We are running out of time. I just want to make one quick comment. We did, and just we will be sending out a notice, save the date for October 19th will be the next on-site meeting for all of you. And Mr. Paul O'Neill has been an invited guest and has accepted our invitation. He will also be then speaking the next morning to all of your CEOs at the Greater New York Board of Governors meeting. So, again, they'll be bought into the quality arena, and they'll get an earful from Paul O'Neill. The training that day will be using the Toyota model, looking at systems and processes. What we have not done yet is secured a location, places that are within our budget are not available. So, again, we're looking for more creative venues. So if anyone has any suggestions or feedback, the Villa Barone that we had the meeting at last time was not available. People did say that was very convenient and easy parking. So I'm trying to find a location that we can have free parking or easy access by public transportation, and we'll keep you posted on that. And the next conference call, just so you know, Dr. Shannon will be on the call. Strongly encourage you to have your material management folks and some finance folks on the call, those who do your budget, because he'll be talking about return on investment and just talking about cost savings related to this project. We really want to make sure that we're bridging those gaps between finance and clinical areas so that they see the value in purchasing those bio patches and packaging these materials together. And we'll also send an email out to your chief financial officers alerting them of the call.
Okay. If there's no other questions, comments, we'll end the call. Thanks, everyone, for joining.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Operator, are there any other questions?
At this time, I'm showing no other questions, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, operator.
Thank you for participating in today's conference. Have a nice day.